My name is Caitlin Hibbard, and I'm a poet and the author of Simples.
Okay, so I'm going to begin just by jumping right in. I'd like you to talk about Simples. What is it that prompted you to compile this particular set of poems, and why at this particular time?
I've been working on this for a number of years, and it was inspired by hearing an episode of the Writer's Almanac. It was the anniversary of the biggest locust invasion in North American history, and it destroyed a swath of like 10,000 acres in the Great Plains in the late 1800s. And something about that caught my imagination. I grew up on a dairy farm, and I realized how horrific it would be to lose literally everything. The grasshoppers ate the clothes off people's clotheslines, their crops, their tools, everything. And it just astounded me to realize what that might have been like. And after doing a little bit more research into that incident, I started to get in touch with the fact that women's voices and women's experience in this period of history, and really in all periods of history, hasn't been voiced as much as I think it should be. I'm also, in addition to being a poet, I am a historian as well. And so the whole idea came together to write from the voices and experience of a variety of women from the late 1800s into the early 1900s. And I wouldn't say that I necessarily represented all women, of course, but I've tried to look at a variety of stories from many other women. So I don't appear in this collection personally, but it's to some extent my ancestors do, and all of our ancestors.
I'm really curious kind of about your process of figuring out kind of how to encapsulate these women's experiences, if you could talk about that a bit.
Well, you know, in some ways I'm a terrible historian because I work very intuitively. And so I read a lot of secondary sources to begin with. I read a fascinating book about women's experience settling the plains. And so I just read this historical material and waited for something to light that little spark that lets you know a poem is going to come from it.
Great. And as we were preparing for the interview, one of the things you said is that sometimes you feel like your poetry might be more articulate than yourself in some ways, which I don't agree. I think you're very articulate. But I thought that would be a really nice opening for us to get the best of both worlds, to hear a piece of your poetry with you reading it, and then maybe we could talk about it afterwards. Would that be okay?
Sure.
So let's start with We Gave Up.
Okay. So this poem has two different voices in it. Well, actually more than two, but the primary part of the poem is the voice of a woman whose family was forced to give up their homestead claim. This happened actually to quite a number of people. And then the alternative voices are politicians and reporters who are opining about how essentially the pioneers were a bunch of slackers who weren't working hard enough. So, and I will tell you a little bit more about the particulars of that after I read.
Okay, great. Thanks for setting it up for us. So yeah, jump right in.
Okay. We gave up. After we lost all the wheat and the beans, the year we ate boiled grass and weeds, when they gave us a dollar for next year's seed, but none to eat turnips today. The needy should be taught self-reliance. After we buried two children, after the fire took our barn, after the grasshoppers came 4 years running. If anybody chooses to lie down and be eaten up by grasshoppers, we don't care much if he is devoured, body, boots, and breeches. When we skimmed 6 bushels from the stream in less than an hour, during the 5th year of drought, after the first cow died, while starvation stared us in the face, poverty and deprivation are incidents of frontier life at its best. Before taking the pauper's oath, before swearing we had nothing to qualify for succor, it is humiliating to have them so constantly before us, passing round the hat. When our neighbors got 10 pounds of pork to last the six of them all year long, demoralization of a class fully capable of self-support. When our pigs froze in the blizzard, the year the snow flew sideways. The lack of supplies exists chiefly among the immigrants. When they said if we just worked hard enough, we could get rid of the grasshoppers. Because burning the earth wouldn't stop them. Because their eggs are known to survive even the bitterest winter. Pluck and perseverance meet with their just reward in the saving of their crops by those who exercise it. Before we gave up the last cow, before we gave up the team and our means to plow, after they said we had too much to deserve any help, we gave up our claim, but not without a fight.
Thank you. That's very powerful. And you said you had some sort of extra kind of notations or points that you wanted to share about that piece?
Yes. I found a lot of these voices, these secondary voices from the book Harvest of Grief, Grasshopper Plagues and Public Assistance in Minnesota, 1873 to 1878 by this amazing historian named Annette Atkins. And anyway, so some of the people who were quoted there were a senator from Dodge County, Minnesota, the governor of Minnesota, John Pillsbury, a report in the Martin County Sentinel on how the people in the East Coast had a lot of attitude about Midwesterners because they kept asking for disaster relief, essentially. And the issue was that to qualify for grasshopper relief, you had to swear that you had no means of supporting yourself, no livestock or supplies, but the amount of aid they gave you wasn't enough to buy enough livestock or supplies to survive for another year. So essentially the program was useless and it forced thousands of people to give up their claims and either move further west or go back east.
That is really interesting. I'm curious if you can think of current day parallels that you see kind of similar to that dynamic. I'm certainly thinking of some, but I'm curious kind of what your lens is and like which iterations we might see this kind of issue appearing today.
Well, I certainly think about unemployment benefits, and I certainly think about healthcare supplements. I think about aid for dependent children. All of these kind of government programs that are supposed to help people barely scratch the surface and force people into desperate situations.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And you know this, but you're speaking to me from Minnesota. I'm talking to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. And here we've seen a lot of people. First of all, when I hear your poem, it's chilling, right? It's heartbreaking, and it's describing hardships and devastation even. And it made me think about pause and think about struggle in general. And so even though we're talking about a different time period, and I'm on the opposite side of the country, in the midst of the Bay Area, one of the most expensive housing markets that are around, where lots of middle-class people are now living in tents, and I had shared this example in the questions I sent you, but just last week a small child died because she was living in a storage shelter with her parents, because that's just kind of the reality. And so I was just curious about what do you hope that people can take away from your poetry, even in different parts of the country, and even though we're in a different time period, what do you hope that we can kind of really extract from it?
Well, I think that's a really good question. And In some ways, I don't know how to answer it because, gosh, who is it that says, you know, you can't get the news from poetry, but men die every day for lack of what is found there?
That is powerful.
I try to remember who I should say that. My former professors would probably feel really bad that I didn't know anymore who said that. But I think William Carlos Williams said that. So anyway, I think, you know, I don't think history repeats itself necessarily because we're always in a different era with a different context, but at the same time, certain lessons about power and privilege and opportunity and control keep coming back to us over and over and over again. And I would hope that people would recognize that this kind of narrative we have for ourselves about hardy pioneers, you know, breaking the prairie and making America, quote unquote, great, didn't come without a price, both for the people who were displaced, both for the land that was destroyed, and for the people who suffered in the process of establishing new cities and states.
Yeah, and the other thing I think of, you know, the poem is called We Gave Up, and right now I think we're at a really interesting crossroads in the country. I think some people are tempted to give up with the social political landscape that we're kind of on. And so, kind of, I'm curious for you as an artist and as a poet, how do you continue to find hope and continue to keep, you know, producing art and not giving up in the context of what feels like a bit of a grim world right now?
Well, it does. And, you know, I have to say, being a teacher helps me keep pushing forward because, you know, my students, I teach at a community college, and most of my students are first generation to go to college. Many of them are immigrants, many of them are people of color, most of them are poor or working class, and they have hope to keep going to make things better, and they give me a lot of hope. I feel like in some ways we're in better shape than we've ever been because I think people have a lot more awareness and a lot more compassion across major social divides. And so, yes, I do feel hope because of my work as a teacher. And I also, you know, you have to do what you can to keep yourself mentally healthy and stable under some insane times. And sometimes, you know, you just have to laugh in horror. I don't know.
That makes sense. And so just before you go on, you're a teacher at a community college. What are you teaching, English or what are you teaching?
I teach research writing, I teach English lit, I teach creative writing, and I also teach women's studies and women's history.
Okay, so you're very busy.
Yes, and I have the best job on the planet. I love my job.
That's amazing. Would you like to read one more poem for us? You can choose. I know I had asked you to choose a couple of your favorites, and you had chosen a couple more, so I'll leave it up to you as to which one you might like to share next.
Well, you know, that's a hard one because they're both very relevant, I think, to women today. But I would like to share one called The Fix.
Okay,
And,
perfect. So you can
okay.
jump right in on that one.
Okay. Uriah had been gone a good 3 weeks when she started to think she might be in a fix again. Already there were the two other babes and no work for him, accounting for his month-long trip to Grove City. He wrote back, said, "Don't stay with your folks in Minnesota too long. You might use some other mild medicine, but nothing very strong." The broker said tansy tea would be best. "You will likely find some growing along the roadside. Steep together its bright yellow buttons and jagged leaves until the camphor smell almost overcomes you. and she had heard of two women who died drinking it. Folks said they took it for the hysteria, but everyone knew what that meant. Take a cup in the morning and another at night while fasting until you are healed of your affliction. She looked at her sleeping children, held the cup to her lips.
That is chilling.
It is. It is. And, you know, this poem, of course, should help us understand that women have been dealing with unwanted pregnancies forever. And the whole idea that, you know, the abortion movement, it was a creation of the feminist movement in the 60s, is utter nonsense. And this actually is based on a letter from a man to his wife, giving her the suggestion of what she might do about the situation. And, you know, he's completely supportive and realistic. And I just kind of imagined myself into her thoughts of what it would be like to go through with that procedure of using a simple, simples refers to herbs, herbal remedies that women frequently use to care for their families in this time period. And so that would have been like, you know, an abortifacient, tansy tea.
I know, and now we're all on the edge of our seats wondering, what does she do? Does she drink the tea? Does she not? And what would you like us to be thinking about right here as we're all sitting wanting to know what happened?
Well, the thing is, I don't know what actually happened, because this happened in Nebraska. This is from a collection I found at the Library of Congress. But there is never any follow-up on what she actually did. I think she did it.
And in the piece where it speaks about, where you speak about women dying while taking this, so there's risk involved. They have to decide about, it sounds like there's kind of three things they could go through with this pregnancy that they don't have the capacity to manage, or they could possibly succeed with an abortion, or it could take their own life. Is that right?
Exactly. Yes. Yes. And I mean, you know, it's one of the things, any remedy can be dangerous. You know, there's no actual science behind the dosage of it, of course. And similarly, you know, even today, women are dying all the time from self-induced abortions, or, you know, taking things that they hear online are going to help them. So it's so important that people have access to reproductive health.
Right. And we know in the U.S. at federal level, in some of the immigration kind of holding sites, they've actually been withholding abortion services to young teenagers. Even there was a few cases like that. And it seems like this, like the whole reproductive rights movement, people feel a lot of insecurity and uncertainty around it right now. So although history doesn't repeat itself per se, it seems like we are, in a sense, reliving a version of history. And at least that's my take. I'm curious what your take is.
Well, absolutely. We keep going through cycles of people having too much power to determine access to health care, access to reproductive rights, and then people rising up, women rising up, and working to get those rights. But we clearly see that you can't ever rest, because they have been working to take that away ever since Roe versus Wade was passed in 1973. I think most people in my generation would certainly never have thought that we would be looking at the steady erosion of those rights 40, 50 years later, but here we are.
May I ask you, because you mentioned your generation, what is your age, or if you want to give us a range, just so we kind of have a sense of that?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm 61.
Okay, thank you. And I feel like, you know, Why don't you go ahead and share the other poem that you had picked out as well?
Okay. Let's see. Okay. The hired man appears in the doorway of the milking shed, a shadow filling the square of light, his face obscured, his eyes unseen, watching her. She turns away, keeps milking, rests her head on Abigail's flank, listens to her deep stomach rumble, pulls her teats, one, two, one, two, rhythmic squirt of warm milk in the pail, and without warning, the stool is gone, and she is sprawled across dirty straw, the pail upended, blue-white stream gathering dirt as it rolls across the cracked floor, her face pushed into hay bales, stacked in the corner, muffled screams withered on bitter wind, the tearing of her muslin underskirt, harsh like an axe cleaving wood. She watches the milk roll across the floor. When will it end? Then slow to a trickle. She prays for God's forgiveness, knows she will soon be punished for losing her morning's work.
Wow, another powerful piece. Can you talk a little bit about that one, kind of the backdrop and your process for this poem?
Sure. I mean, this is sounding like grim on grim on grim. I promise not all the poems are this, like, you know, devastating. But I guess I really did want to portray the fact that there was a lot of hardship, and hardship similar to the hardships that women face today. This isn't based on a particular incident. This is imagined from what I thought it would have been like and how it could have happened, simply because there were many people who had hired men working for them. They were kind of itinerant, ne'er-do-well, sometimes people who would just travel around looking for work, and they would stay for a harvest and then move on, and they didn't have any sense of community or obligation necessarily to the people they were working for. And I just thought about how vulnerable a woman would be in a situation like that, where she was out in the middle of nowhere and she didn't know this guy and didn't have any power to stop him. And so I just imagined what that encounter would have been like for her. A number of women, they also would hire women who traveled around the countryside for helping with the milking and that kind of thing. And sometimes they would get pregnant and then they would get sent back to their families where they came from. And so I read that statistic and then I thought, well, how exactly would these pregnancies occur? And then it just kind of came to me like, oh, of course, a lot of them were, you know, I wouldn't say all of them were a result of rape, but I can't help but think many of them would have been.
Right, or at a minimum, like, there's definitely going to be a difference in power and social stature and all of that, right?
Yes.
Powerful. And another really good segue for the other topic I was going to talk to you about, which is kind of connecting these poems from this different time period to issues that we've got going on right now. And you talked about kind of choosing women from this era because you thought they were somewhat voiceless. And we know that hasn't necessarily gone away. But with the whole Me Too movement, we've seen a lot of women kind of finding their voice or finding their courage to come forward after other women have come forward. And we've actually seen really important men actually lose jobs. Matt Lauer is one of them, right? as we're seeing all of this, again, from your perspective as an artist and as a poet, a historian, an instructor, what are kind of your thoughts about this cycle of history, or maybe the progress that we're making, even though it's very slow?
Well, you know, I really feel kind of hopeful that this, we're in a real, you know, watershed moment, that there will be some actual radical change in terms of how gender politics continue to play out. Because it's a collective movement, because it's based on women coming forward and then more women coming forward. I mean, as many horrible things as can be said about social media, I think one of its great powers is the ability to connect people from all over and to empower people from all over. And so I think, yeah, I feel pretty darn hopeful about it. I would never have guessed that Matt Lauer would topple and fall.
I know. I couldn't believe it. I mean, and then some people were saying, well, it took a couple of months for him to go. And I thought, I think there's people in each of our workplaces that probably we know have done this kind of behavior and they stay there. So for them to take a stand like that. And we also saw NBC take a stand during Trump's campaign with Billy Bush. I don't know if you recall that.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, so it is a very interesting time indeed. And
I also
go ahead.
I'm sorry. I also think, though, that, you know, there are two things. One is that there is a lot more to be done in terms of people not working in high profile positions, like in, you know, the news or in politics. You know, I'm thinking about working class women, women working in factories, women working in restaurants, working in hotels. So there is a lot of vulnerability that still needs to be addressed. And I also don't want there to be the kind of backlash that tells us that, you know, women are frail and vulnerable, and what we need is to have less interaction between men and women. I think, no, that's nonsense. That's not what we need. We need to call it like it is and look at power differentials and how boys are taught a certain way to interact with girls and girls are taught to put up and shut up.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you brought up, you know, the class issue as well, right? And so if it's taking women in these very high profile positions this amount of time and courage to come forward, then what about the person who's doing a service job who might also be an immigrant who might feel very vulnerable? So thank you for remembering those folks as well. I am curious how you think your work, or maybe your work as a poet, and particularly around this collection, maybe when you're reading it, how do you hope it might inspire women from these different spaces and serve as a source of healing for them?
Gosh, I hope it does. I mean, I hope that, you know, in some situations it might inspire people to learn more about their history. I think, you know, one of the things that is true is that art can teach us things that academia might not necessarily deliver. So I'm hoping that this helps people really reimagine their history and feel a sense of ownership around it. Because it's accessible and I think engaging and personal in a way that reading an account in a history book might not be.
Well said. And my last few questions are just really about you as a poet and as an artist. And I think you started to talk a little bit about this, but I wanted to give you some space to talk more about kind of your artistic process and how you manage your writing practice, how you really went about putting this whole collection together and then seeing it through all the way to publication.
Well, I write pretty slowly. I've been working on this book for about 7 years, and because I teach full time at a community college, and we teach quite a lot because the focus is on teaching rather than research. So during the school year, my production is pretty small, but I'm also very fortunate to be able to apply for sabbatical every 7 years. And so 7 years ago, I started this work. And then in my last sabbatical, which was a couple years ago, I finally felt like I brought it to fruition by really focusing on it. I also got a tattoo of a grasshopper, which I think, you know, is kind of a talisman that really helped me complete the manuscript.
That is so cool. So you got your tattoo when you were like 60 or something?
Yes.
I love it. That is really fun. And so what would you say is the most important lesson that you learned from, you know, this long 7-year process of putting this collection together?
Well, I would say, you know, one is perseverance. And I find that every time I sit down to write, just having faith in the process, having faith that something good and worthwhile will come of it. And I also have learned that I think I would have been a terrible homesteader if I had to go without coffee for one day. I think, you know, I would turn around and go back east.
I love it. And so for you, how many like publishing companies did you consult to find the right home for your work?
Oh my gosh. I could have opened that file and counted them, but I've been sending it out, you know, periodically for a good couple of years. And I looked at contests, and I also looked at places that I thought would be interested in this kind of book. And because I've published 2 other books, I was aware that this could be a very lengthy process. So I didn't really give up necessarily, but, you know, the style of this book isn't like a lot of contemporary poetry I'm reading. It's, you know, maybe more narrative in some places, and it's very woman focused, and it's not deconstructed in the way a lot of poetry seems to be in fairly recent years. So I knew it was going to be a while before I found the right place. And so now I'm very thrilled that it's coming from a Midwestern publishing house. That seems absolutely perfect.
And of course I have to ask, how did you find Howling Bird Press, and talk about that whole process?
Well, I probably read the call for the poetry prize, probably in Poets and Writers. Or I could have seen it on Facebook too. I'm not entirely sure, but I'm always kind of keeping my ear out for places. And yeah.
So and I when thought, did you well, get your news that you were selected?
Well, I was walking around in the dog park waiting for my dogs to stop chasing squirrels, and the phone rang, and there was the good news.
Nice. And what do you hope to do to really, now that, you know, we have a plan for your work to be released to the world, what do you imagine doing to help promote it? Do you imagine like a book tour or some readings or?
Well, I definitely, you know, I love to read. And so I will definitely be reading in as many places in the Twin Cities as possible. I'm also teaching a workshop in New Mexico this summer, so I hope to promote the book there as well. And I'll go anywhere.
And I also want to ask you, we know that the life of a poet or an artist is, you know, a lot of people discourage those things, right? Because they think they're not going to come to fruition or produce a whole bunch of money. But what words of wisdom might you offer to people, especially women who are writers and artists, and they're also balancing other tasks like teaching, mothering, caregiving, that kind of thing? What words of wisdom would you offer them about kind of pulling off a balance or pursuing their passion, even if it doesn't make practical sense?
Oh, well, yeah, it totally doesn't make practical sense. I mean, and you can't, you aren't going to make money being a poet for sure, but, you know, that's just how it is. And I guess I would just tell people to believe in yourself and listen to your voice. It has value. Follow whatever sets your heart on fire.
And as a historian, I'm interested in your take on the last question that I'd shared with you. But you've, you know, researched people from way back to the 1800s, maybe further. And then you're alive and well and seeing all the changes in the current social and political landscape. So for you, what does the rhythm of change mean, and how do you see it applying to the world and to your life?
Well, I was kind of flummoxed by that question.
That's because fair. Take it any direction you'd like.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that change happens not in a straight line, or really, yeah, not in a straight line. I feel like change is sort of a spiral. I think that we gyrate. I think we go out wide and wild and come back to a center. This all sounds kind of woo-woo. I don't know how to really articulate it, but I don't think that change is, or progress is, a straight line. I think that progress in and of itself is sometimes a questionable concept. I think we lose something sometimes by focusing so much on progress and change. But I also think that we're always in a struggle of sorts between, you know, people who have too much power over others and people who are fighting to have their voices heard. And, you know, sometimes the balance shifts, and I'm hoping that that balance continues to shift in our current political moment.
Great. Is there anything else that you'd like to add, or a question that you wish I had asked you that I didn't?
Oh, no. I'm so grateful to have this opportunity to publish this book. And I'm really excited that it was chosen by students, because, you know, I think that just makes me feel really happy that people of your generation find value in this kind of work. So okay. I'm flattered.
Fantastic.